Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Coming up on Daily Tech News Show, why the Navy is moving away from touchscreens, why Chrome's incognito mode still can be detected, and using a bog to create electricity. This is the Daily Tech News for Monday, August 12th, 2019 in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
And from Studio Feline, I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm the show's producer, Roger Chang.
We were just talking about luggage and TSA security and Roger wearing a bathrobe to his own wedding. If you want to know more about that, by all means, become a patron at patreon.com/DTNS and get the wider show where we talk about technology and more called Good Day Internet. That's patreon.com/DTNS. Let's start with a few tech things you should know. Oh, come on.
India's Reliance Industries announced a partnership with Microsoft Azure. Reliance's Jio will build data centers using Azure to provide things like natural language understandings for all Indian languages and dialects, which is no small feat. There are many of them. Jio will also provide free connectivity and cloud infrastructure to startups, as well as plans for small and medium businesses for as little as 1,500 rupees. That's about $21.05 per month.
Researchers at Checkpoint Software demonstrated using the picture transfer protocol over Wi-Fi or USB to install ransomware, that's right, ransomware, on a Canon 80D DSLR and encrypt the images on your SD card to prevent access. Counterpoint and Canon have been working on a patch since May. The researchers said that any cameras using the picture transfer protocol could be vulnerable to a similar attack.
After Tyler Blevins, a.k.a. Ninja, left Twitch to move to Mixer, Twitch was using his old Twitch channel to promote other Fortnite players on Twitch. This weekend, a pornography channel managed to get itself at the top of Twitch's Fortnite recommendations and then got promoted to Ninja's old channel, which, as you can imagine, caused some drama. Twitch reverted the page to a standard archival mode. Twitch CEO Emmett Shear said that the offending channel had been suspended and apologized directly to Ninja.
You know, sometimes when you get trolly, you get trolled. That just happens. Samsung's share of the European smartphone market rose from 33.9% last year to 40.6%, mostly on increased sales of mid-range phones like the Galaxy A50, one of their top three sellers in Europe. Xiaomi also grew in Europe by 50% to 9.6% of the market. Everybody else had a harder time.
And as promised, Huawei launched a device running its new Hongmeng or Harmony OS, the Honor Vision Smart TV. The 55-inch TV starts at 3,799 won or about US 538.
All right, let's talk a little more about image sensor company Samsung has a new product.
Samsung. It's got a new title every week. Samsung unveiled the ISOCELL Bright HMX smartphone camera sensor, which offers up to 108 megapixels of resolution. That's a lot. The sensor was developed with Xiaomi and is one of the largest smartphone camera sensors at about 3/4 of an inch. By default, the sensor will use pixel binning, combining 4 pixels into one to capture high-quality 27-megapixel images. That's 27-megapixel images. This helps with low-light performance. The sensor also has smart ISO, which adjusts the ISO levels to compensate for bright or dim environments. The sensor is also capable of capturing 6K video at 30 frames per second, and production of the new sensor is expected to begin again this month.
Yeah, 108 megapixels is going to be in all the headlines, but the fact that you're getting better low light and light sensitive performance from the pixels being used to create a 27 megapixel image is, I think, going to have more of an impact if you get a phone with this sensor in it. It'll be interesting to see if that smart ISO post-processing ends up being as good as it looks, but that could be pretty helpful as well. You know, coming at this from the positive end, you're like, hey, this is a really big sensor for a smartphone, which can do some pretty high quality image capture. But Roger, when you compare this to actual camera sensors, not that impressive, is it?
It's up there with upper tier point and shoots, but not premium point and shoots. So you're definitely getting a very large sensor for a smartphone, but it is kind of on the small. It is definitely on the small end for cameras. I mean, it's roughly 33 millimeters diagonally, and comparatively, like if you dealt with a Canon APS-C, which is a crop sensor, that you're dealing with 329 millimeters. So you might be asking, well, what's the big deal? The big deal is that in order to get more sensitivity without having a lot of noise, that kind of grain artifacting that you get with your picture, you need a larger sensor, or you need to turn into a lot of post-processing or software processed to kind of eliminate a lot of that noise in the image before it gets to you, the end user.
So not every phone is going to be able to take advantage of this large of a sensor, or is going to want to based on its design. But it would improve the quality of pictures in a lot of smartphones, no?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it depends on how it's implemented, but it does have the great potential to improve, you know, the shots that you take with your phone when you're, you know, for a night on the town, or if you're at a, like, you know, special occasion, or you just pull it out because you see something really awesome. But again, I think a lot of the feature set will be in the post-processing of the image.
Well, and that's why they made such a big deal about that smart ISO being built in. That means, you know, Huawei does a lot of post-processing, you know, so does Android, so does the iPhone. But having it built in on the sensor, you know, takes a little bit of the pressure off.
It takes the pressure off, but it also guarantees, at least ideally, it should guarantee you the same image quality regardless of what manufacturer implements that phone, that camera in the phone.
You know, as somebody who used to really be into digital cameras before our phones were all our digital cameras, you know, I remember when 16 megapixels was like, whoa, that is so cool. Like that's you know, and it's so small. And there are so many proprietary names for cool sensors. You know, the size is size, and megapixels are megapixels. But I can't be the only one who at this point is like, if it takes good pictures in low light, great.
Yeah, and that's what they're aiming at. They're aiming for the consumer who doesn't want to think about specs, who doesn't want to think about, you know, how many lumens I can get, how dark it. They just want to be able to press the button. They get a picture that they can share with friends and family. Say, hey, look, we have a birthday photo with grandma, you know, at the night at Chevy's or Chi-Chi's, went out of business. Pick your favorite restaurant that your family hangs out at. And that's all they care about. And if it does that, they're happy.
All right, folks, touch screens away. And by away, I mean away from our boats. The U.S. Navy announced it will revert destroyers from touch screens to mechanical throttle and helm control systems over the next 18 to 24 months. This is because a crash off the coast of Singapore between a Liberian oil tanker and the USS John S. McCain on August 21st, 2017, killed 10 sailors and injured 48, and a comprehensive review by the Navy found that the crew had placed the touchscreens on that destroyer in backup manual mode, removing computer-assisted help, because it gave them a, quote, more direct form of communication between steering and the SSC, the touchscreen console. It also meant, however, that any crew member at another station could take over steering, causing control to shift, in this case, from the lee helm to aft steering to the helm and back to the aft steering. And that's when they lost control of the destroyer. The NTSB found that crews preferred mechanical controls because, quote, they provide both immediate and tactile feedback to the operator, meaning they think they would have caught this situation a lot faster if they had had that tactile feedback. Following safety testing, the first new throttles are scheduled to be installed by summer 2020. The reports did find that fatigue of the crew played a part in this, as well as insufficient training on this particular touchscreen console.
This sounds like a really a kind of an object lesson and bad user interface.
Yeah.
Well, and inadequate training. If there was a manual mode that it shouldn't have been in, but was because it was easier at the time when everything was going well, that's insufficient training too.
Or at least they should have known how to recover and what the risks of using that manual mode were. Roger, you were saying you found something that implied that these you worked differently on different.
Well, so the interfaces aren't the same across all the ships, and so. From what I understand, like there was really no guidance for the contractors when they designed these. Like all the interfaces, like you know in Star Trek, all the helms kind of look the same. They have bars that navigate and not the rest. So that was left up to the contractors. And so you basically, as Sarah was saying, there was not enough training to teach them on this specific system. If there was a more standardized set, then you could kind of train them in the process as they were upcrewing instead of just having it specific to the ship, because there's enough ship-specific systems that you have to learn. Also, you know, if it's too complicated, and I know this from very bad car dashes, when you're tired, things that normally you think would be somewhere that aren't there really frustrate you, and an emergency can be incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, you almost have to revert to muscle memory sometimes. You know, the way that you wouldn't want your touch screen to be your brake pedal.
Yeah, imagine if someone flipped the brake and the gas pedal on your car. You know what I mean? Like it's
right.
It's not, you know, it's a little simplistic, but you learn certain things, well, and they're in specific spots, and ideally they would have kind of
driving in a country that drives on the opposite side of the road of your country while you're jet lagged. is can be frightening, right? Because everything's in the wrong place and you're tired. I say that from experience driving in Australia last year. So yeah, this is no joke. I think it means that touchscreens need more work on their design before they are re-implemented. I don't know that it means that mechanical controls will continue to always be preferential. It just means that you need to work a lot harder to make them foolproof, literally.
Yeah, I guess my overall feeling is the training could have been better, but hey, if we're talking about destroyer ships, well, give them what they want.
Yeah, it's a big ship. Doesn't move quick, you know?
Yeah. Right. Just make it safe. That's what it takes. Go for it. At the DEF CON voting village, DARPA showed off an open source secure voting machine being designed by Oregon-based verifiable systems firm Galois. The chips are being designed as open hardware with no proprietary components in order to make them the basis to a secure hardware platform, which would be useful for IoT. The DARPA machines ran on virtualized hardware this year with a basic interface provided by secure voting firm Voting Works. The machine prints out selections with a QR code for a cryptographic validity check, and DARPA plans to complete systems access at DEF CON in 2020. The system offers a code repository at securehardware.org and plans a small test board as well.
Yeah, so usually the Voting Village, and this year is no exception, is a place where folks can hack away on election machines to try to find vulnerabilities so they can be fixed in the future. And this one has had the opportunity for people to look for software bugs. In fact, they had an open web server hidden in there on purpose because they said, hey, we want to see if people can find it. And when they do, we think we walled off the rest of the system. So even when they find that server, they can't do damage. But we want to know if that's for sure or not. So this is all good stuff. This is making these voting machines more secure. I think even beyond that, the idea of having a platform that is getting this kind of treatment and this kind of focus in the voting village, but could also provide more secure hardware for Internet of Things. For instance, there was a recent vulnerability in one of the Internet of Things operating systems that you just have to wait for your IoT device maker to fix. Otherwise, you are really at risk and it's impossible for you to really know for sure the way things are. You want some hardware security in these things, and that could be a huge benefit for IoT. At least I think so.
Agreed.
Looking forward to finding out what this looks like when they bring the actual hardware platform next year. So try and help us remember to check in.
And Shannon Morse, our guest tomorrow, who was at DEF CON, is going to give us a great roundup of all the other stuff that she saw and observed there as well.
In Chrome 76, Google fixed Chrome's incognito mode. We talked about this on the show before, if you missed it. Previously, the Chrome file system API was disabled in incognito mode. So if a site wanted to be able to tell if you were in incognito mode, they would look for that API. If it wasn't there, they would assume you're in incognito mode. Well, to get around this, Chrome 76 now leaves the Chrome file system API enabled so that if you're checking for the file system, it'll be there. And you can't tell if someone's in incognito mode or not from that. However, to preserve privacy, because you don't want that file system sitting on a hard drive afterwards, the file system is using a transient memory file system that's cleared when the session is closed. If you know what a RAM disk is, it's kind of like that. However, this memory-based transient system leads to two new ways to detect incognito users. Security researcher Vikas Mishra found that incognito allocates a maximum of 120 megabytes of memory to the transient file system, and that's something that would normally only happen if the device storage was less than 2.4 gigabytes, because it's usually based on a scale of relative to what you have on your machine. Knowing that most devices don't have 2.4 gigabytes of device storage, they figured, okay, that's an easy way to tell. If it's 120 megabytes, probably incognito mode. Another method discovered by researcher Jesse Lee measures the speed of writing to the file system, because writing to a transient file system in memory is a lot faster than writing to a hard drive. That's why RAM disks are so cool, because you can write and read from them real fast. Microsoft Edge developer Eric Lawrence notes the New York Times seems to already be using Mishra's code that detects the 120 megabyte file to detect incognito. You can see it in the code inspector. Google told Bleeping Computer it will, quote, work to remedy any other current or future means of incognito mode detection. And I'm sure the New York Times and others with paywalls will work to immediately figure out a new way to tell if you're in incognito mode.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned paywalls. That's the main reason that a publisher or anybody running a site would care whether you're in incognito mode or not, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's all kinds of other like nefarious reasons that people targeting you might have if they want to build up a dossier of your illicit activities that you're putting in incognito mode, I guess. But yeah, the most common reason that you're going to run into this is trying to get around a paywall. So it's not necessarily the best, most ethical reason, but there is the principle of when you're in incognito mode, you don't want anybody to be able to tell that. That's right. Part of the reason you're using incognito mode.
For whatever. You're incognito, yeah. Supposedly.
It's supposed to protect your privacy from anything out there, good or bad, right? That's kind of the point of it. So this is difficult because, yes, it's unethical to use it to get around a paywall, but it also is meant to protect you from legitimate threats. And right now, there are two ways to get around that.
I know folks who are incognito mode 100% of the time.
Yeah, just because they're like, yeah, I don't need any.
Like, if website, it's an option, why wouldn't I just always use it?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not 100% foolproof, but why not? It's right there. It's just a little switch.
It'll make your life a little less practical because, you know, there's certain things that make life easier when a website knows who you are and can set cookies and all that sort of thing. But
it's an option for a reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Sony announced an updated version of its XAVAX5000, which is an in-car receiver. This one lets drivers at a 9.95-inch floating touchscreen display. It doesn't actually float, but it can be adjusted. It needs a single DIN to install. DIN refers to about a 2-inch by 8-inch opening that radios fit into. So the opening needs to be a lot smaller than what the screen will actually be.
It kind of floats out in front of it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like a TV mount that can tilt and go up and down. The display can tilt and adjust the height and depth. It features support for CarPlay and Android Auto through USB, hands-free voice control, Bluetooth connectivity, and in future updates will support Abalta's WebLink platform as well. The display will be available in the US in December for $600. That's a pretty penny, but it's cheaper than some of the comparable models of these sorts of things. On the car front, Bosch is developing 3D imaging to future versions of its in-car digital displays using passive 3D tech that won't require you to wear glasses or require you as a driver to look from one specific spot. So you're, you know, it's not tracking your eyesight basically, which is actually extremely
cool.
You
don't have to like lean down and look, oh, now I see the 3D, right?
Yeah. Right. Where, you know, with my own car, I've got a heads up display. But if I deviate from where my car seat is just a little bit, I can't see my miles per hour. You know, so it's all very
well. There have been some TVs with glasses free 3D where it's like you have to sit in right in front of it, otherwise it doesn't work.
Exactly. So alerts, navigation, parking cameras can all take advantage of this technology when it is available, and we don't have any word on consumer availability at this time.
You know, this kind of reminds me of that story you did a couple of weeks ago about how a lot of accidents involving automobiles, drivers and their phone wasn't because there was the phone usage, just because they were taking their eyes off the road. And if, you know, if you can implement a system that kept people's eyeballs straightforward and still be able to alert them, that would be great, because a lot of touchscreens still require you to crank your head over, and then you got to mess with your, you know, mess with it a little bit with your hand in order to get to where you want. And that takes your.
Is that what this 3D display does, though? Well, I mean, because it's still down in the dash to your right.
But the way I understood it is that when you looked at it, it wasn't, you didn't need, you could, you being 3D, you would be able to see it slightly, not you didn't have to cant your head. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the story then, because I thought it was designed so that it could present the 3D projection a little bit.
Yeah, it's not like a heads up display. I think I think what's good about it is you don't have to point your head in the right direction to see the 3D, right?
And so that's right. That's right.
Okay. So when you know, so it can do some 3D stuff and you don't have to like position yourself to see it, but you're still looking down. It's not in your field of vision.
It's like, okay, so my heads up display will, I mean, there's some customization, but it's like I got my miles per hour and it'll also flash things like school crossing signs. Just, you know, if I'm not aware that there's a school coming up, it's like 25 miles per hour, you know, tops.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but that's something that I can only see in one place. I could be like briefly looking at, you know, my passenger side rearview mirror, and I could see that alert because that's where I'm looking at that particular moment. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Well, the 3D display doesn't do that, does it? I think it just points right from your console down to your right, if I'm looking at this display properly.
Well, no, I mean, that's the whole point, is that you don't have to be looking in one specific place.
Well, no, that means I don't have to be, I can see the 3D on the screen from any angle. It doesn't mean that the 3D shows up anywhere I look.
Oh, man, really?
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Thought it was a little cooler than it was. Cool, this is so cool. Yeah.
It can do things like, you know, show you the map that you're looking at in 3D so that you can see clearly, like, oh, it's not this turn, it's the next one, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, and part of the stuff, I think part of what's throwing off is because some of the photos actually show the dash, like the instrument dash, and not just the screen, is also being 3D.
Yeah, I guess you could put it in the rearview mirror. You could put it in a heads-up display, and it would be a little nicer and pop out to you.
I mean, you know, it's better than one of those paintings where you actually had to stare at it for a couple of seconds to actually see the effect. I think 3D is more than just – you can set up a system of alerts where, depending on how 3D it is, it's more important and less important.
Easier to catch your attention. They also say parking cameras could give you a more accurate 3D view as you're backing into a space. That kind of stuff. So yeah, the 3D stuff is interesting. That probably not as practical or as everyday interesting as the Sony thing, where you can get an aftermarket big old touchscreen, right?
So many. There are at least four or five companies that have something similar, but not like OEM style, where, hey, this is all the stuff my friend has, and I didn't need to buy a new car.
All right, Engadget has an article on using bacteria to generate electricity. Microorganisms called Geobacter purify water by consuming waste and then excrete electrons, which can be harvested as energy. Geobacter grow in mud, and biologist, designer, and artist Teresa Van Dongen found a very well-thriving ecosystem of Geobacter in a water-filled bomb crater in the Dutch countryside and has created an installation called Mudwell. Van Dongen has placed a telescope-like device with one end in the water and the other end out where a viewer can look through it and see a light display oscillate powered by the Geobacter. Now, she's worked with Geobacter before, but she usually needs to give it vinegar for fuel, whereas the mud well has enough Geobacter growing that it's self-sustaining.
Wow. First of all, vinegar for fuel. Okay. I got a lot of that in my kitchen. But this is so incredibly cool, as not just, you know, some sort of an art installation, but an actual, you know, thinking ahead. All of the mud that we avoid for the most part for this to actually be contributing to electricity in some form that would serve a lot of folks at some point is really cool.
Yeah. And, you know, I love this idea that an art institute, it's being funded as an art installation, is bringing to light the idea that, hey, you know what? You know, we've known that Geobacter exists and we've known that they provide a little bit of power, but we've never really seen it at scale. And she has worked with it enough that she's like, this is the biggest electrical output of any Geobacter I've ever worked with. You know, the fact that I don't have to give it any fuel it means that it's self-sustaining. And it, you know, granted, I don't know how practical it is to go around and, you know, dig out bomb crater size holes and fill them up with water, hoping a bog of Geobacter, you know, trying to see what Geobacter is. But it's certainly worth investigation. And it's nice to see art bringing our attention to something that then can be investigated for that.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of lowland areas where you would think that this kind of microorganism would be thriving in other parts of the world as well.
Yeah, and we're always looking for new battery tech too, right? Like, who knows if maybe after some more research is applied to Geobacter, and I'm not trying to imply that there isn't a lot of research on Geobacter going on right now, but maybe if it gets a few more eyes on it, we start to figure out and how to make biological batteries. And then suddenly those battery issues we have with lithium ion batteries, which we've been stuck with for decades now, finally gets replaced. Maybe not. You know, maybe this isn't it either, but I'm always fascinated by that. And if nothing else, it's a way to show that there are a lot more power sources out there to be explored than just the typical solar, coal, oil, et cetera, and wind. I don't know if this is going to work for me though. We don't get enough water. I'll probably have to stick with solar here.
Yeah, we don't have enough bogs in LA.
We're bog deficient.
Yes, yeah. We are.
Well, folks, if you want to get all the tech headlines each day in about 5 minutes, be sure to subscribe to DailyTechHeadlines.com.
Hi, this is Matt.
And Sean.
From Two Black Guys.
With good credit. From a local business to a global corporation.
Partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Hey, thanks to everybody who participates in our subreddit. You help us choose our stories every day. Keep it up. Submit stories and vote on them at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com. We're also on Facebook. Join our group if you haven't already. Facebook.com/groups/dailytechnewsshow. All right, let's move on to Chris Christensen, the amateur traveler, has some fairly big news for those of us who fly Southwest and also like a good deal.
This is Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler with another Tech in Travel Minute. I don't know if you know, but not all budget airlines are listed in the online search engines like Expedia. The one in the U.S. that is most noticeably missing is Southwest Airlines. Southwest has never allowed their flights to be listed. And as someone who used to be the director of engineering at TripAdvisor Flights, let me tell you that this announcement that they're now going to let them be listed on two different back-end systems is a hell freezes over kind of moment. You probably haven't heard of Travelport and Amadeus, but they're used at the back end of some of the online flight search engines. This will happen in 2020, and it means that as you're searching for your flight, you'll find Southwest flights along with the other flights. And that will give you a better booking experience. I'm Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, every flight search I did was Travelocity.
Everything and then
and Southwest. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it was Expedia and Southwest or Kayak and Southwest, whatever I was using at the time, right? Still is to a large extent, although Southwest doesn't always fly to the places that I need to direct. And I like to, you know, as I get older, put a little more emphasis on the direct flight. But this is great to know. This, like he said, is a hell freezes over minute, right?
Yeah, it had been such a part of my looking at flight experience. I stopped feeling inconvenienced by it. It was like, oh yeah, and let's also look at Southwest.
Yeah, it just becomes muscle memory.
Yeah.
All right, let's check out the mailbag.
Let's do it. Mick in Australia weighed in on our Friday discussion with Raj Dayut on satellite internet in Australia. What's good? What isn't good? And Mick says for him, it's not a speed issue so much as data caps and restricted timing. Mick says satellite broadband prices are high in comparison to fixed wired or wireless NBN. A small amount of monthly data is allocated, then is then further split into peak and off-peak. Off-peak gets the lion's share of the allotted data, but that's from like 1 a.m. in the morning to 7 a.m. in the morning. $135 a month for 150 gigabytes. 130 gigabytes of that is off-peak. 15 gigabytes at peak. So 15 gigabytes to do homework or to use social media or to watch Netflix and other streaming. It's just not possible. Prior to SkyMuster, Nick says, being launched, we had NBM satellite on even worse plans, 80 gigabytes per month for $90. That's what he paid with peak and off-peak times. It was stressful having to watch the data limits every day to make sure the kids could do their homework. Prior to that, Australia had what was called ABG, Australian Broadband Guarantee, again, satellite-based, and only about 30 gigabytes per month for $80. Mick finally says there are only really two options, even though he lives 5 kilometers outside the center of his nearest town. Satellites or faking our address so we can get a 4G modem. We have to use external antennas for, only available in certain locations, very limiting. Nick says, we finally feel like we can use the internet for fun now with this new plan for 500 gigabytes per month of data, which was a recent upgrade.
Yeah, no matter what you talk about, there's always somebody left out. So Mick, thank you for sharing that perspective with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, thanks to all of our listeners. Without you, we would be nothing.
Yes, exactly. In fact, I want to meet some of you. If you're going to be in Dublin Saturday, August 17th, that's this Saturday at 6 p.m. Dublin time, come on by Laguna. Laguna's right in front of the Mayor Square NCI stop on the Lewis Red Line. You can go to laguna.ie if you want to find out more information on how to find them. But thanks to Paolo for helping me figure this out. And let us know, feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com, if you plan to come, because we want to get an estimated count. I know of a couple people who are coming for sure. It's going to be a lot of fun. And it also means that I will not be on Daily Tech News Show but for starting tomorrow for a week and a half, well, 2 weeks, basically. I'll be back on the 26th. I'm going to be going to Worldcon for Sword and Laser, covering the Worldcon, which is where they give the Hugo Awards for science fiction books out. And then I'm taking a little vacation and then I'm coming back. So do come meet me in Dublin again, Saturday, August 17th at 6 p.m. And everybody else, like Sarah said, thank you for supporting us. We have a very small independent operation here, but we're able to do bigger and bigger things, like those bonus episodes we did this weekend about Amazon Ring and their issues, about Libra and the reality behind it, because you are our bosses, and you were the people we're answerable to. So if that makes sense to you, come and support us at patreon.com/DTNS.
If you're excited for Sarah and Roger and all our fabulous contributors to keep the ship afloat while Tom is on vacation and doing his meetups, well, write us. Our email address is feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. We're also live Monday through Friday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live.
Back tomorrow will be Shannon Morris with them. I'll talk to you on the 26th.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.